Hi, and welcome back to the Childhood Development Initiative's Restorative Practice podcast, where we talk all things RP. For this second season, we resume visiting communities and organisations to collect stories from practitioners around Ireland. We talk to young people, teachers, lecturers, youth and community workers, and restorative practices trainers to gather their insights on the impact of RP in their life and work. Each episode is focusing either on a place with several voices or on a practitioner. If you are not familiar with restorative practices, the restorative approach, the restorative questions, and the work CDI does, you can listen to the first episode of season one of our podcast series where it is all explained.
Hi, I'm Dorothy Danu, Restorative Practice Quality Specialist for CDI, and I'm delighted to be back on the road for this second season of Circles of Connection. This episode and the previous one are focused on teachers' voice in primary and secondary school. They talk about their training, the shift in mindset and culture that RP fosters, their practices, modeling or explicitly teaching RP, the challenges they meet, and what they learn from them. The contexts in primary and secondary levels are quite different. We were in a primary school for the last episode, and in this one, I went to Castleknock College in Dublin to meet Tom McGully, Kira O'Byrne, and James O'Loughlin. First, Tom and Kira introduce themselves and the college and talk about how they discovered RP and the impact it had on them. Kira mentioned she's an SEN coordinator, which stands for Special Educational Needs. She also talks about the DEEP, which is an abbreviation for the Higher Diploma of Education that you need to get to be a teacher.
Hi, my name is Tom McGully, and I've been a teacher here since 1998, teaching history, RE, and philosophy mainly. I'm also year ahead for 5th years, and I coach rugby with the development, the TY team. And my involvement with RP goes back to about 2015. So, as you said, Dorothy, you were in Castleknock College, and you're very welcome. The college, it's a bit older than me. It's been here since 1835. And actually where we're recording this is part of the oldest part of the building. It's an all boys secondary school. We've just over 750 students across 6 years, from first year through to sixth year, anywhere between 125 and 145 per year. So it's a busy school. It's a bustling school. It's a lively school. And it's a good place to work. I enjoy working here. I think that there's a very positive and supportive atmosphere, and a very positive and supportive relationship and working relationship between staff and staff and students as well. Like when I was doing my teacher training, it was 1997 to 98 in UCD. It was called the HDIP then. It was a 1 year higher diploma, and it was a good course. There were some great lecturers, but there was nothing approaching restorative practices. In actual fact, there was little, if any, training or preparation for how to be a teacher, how to allow yourself or give yourself permission in a way to shine as a teacher. Because I think one thing that we all have in common, regardless of whether we're teaching in primary or secondary or the third level sector or other educational sectors, is it's a caring profession. And I think it draws people who have a natural inclination towards that. It's a people profession as well. So I think relationship is the key. And for me, RP in 2015, what happened was there was an email was forwarded by the deputy principal at the time to staff, and it just piqued my curiosity. And there was an email advertising a level one training with the amazing Michelle Stowe in Connect RP. And so I signed up with a certain amount of ignorance as to what I was letting myself in for. And it's changed my teaching. It did put a structure and a vocabulary on what I was, I think, what was in me, intrinsically. But it gave me a very, very clear framework on how to implement that. And for me, it's perfectly named restorative practices, because the restorative element of it was something that I always identified with. Going back to my own school days, you can tell, even though I didn't know what the word restorative meant when I was in school, But you can tell who are the teachers who care and who are the kind-hearted teachers. And you can also tell which of my teachers were just punching their card. And, you know, and I think each of us will probably have one or two teachers in our lives that have drawn us towards education. And it's down to them. And it's like what Maya Angelou said, it's who they were as people. You know, that's I forget how to conjugate verbs in the passé composé, you know, but I don't forget that my French teacher, for example, was a wonderful person who was really invested in her teachers. So there's so many people who light the way for you. And what I discovered in the training with Michelle, you know, doing level one, level two, level three, was that she set a great inspiration as well. She modeled she models RP so well. But she also gave the practices, the framework to go with that. So like for me, the restorative philosophy, if you like, was revolutionary because it allowed me to come out of maybe an older, more arcane way of approaching teaching, which was authoritarian rather than authoritative. And I wouldn't call it retributive, but there was a certain amount of that. You don't smile till Christmas or you don't smile till Easter, you know, and you keep your guard up, you put your armor on. And that was being given not just permission, but being given a framework and a roadmap and very concrete steps in the practice element of it, starting with check-ins. I remember doing my first check-in with my first year class, probably week three or four into the training. And I was really nervous about doing it because I was putting myself out there, you know, and this was a big step for me. And it's something that now that is, it's routine in my classes and the guys really enjoy it. It helps build a sense of respect, a sense of, I think, equity among the students as well, that everyone's voice matters, and a sense of trust and safety. And I think that's so important. And from that, I think everything that we do in education depends on solid connection and relationships and respect. For me, you know, one of the things that Michelle instilled as well, and I've tried to bring into my own teaching, is like, what are my values as a teacher? And as year ahead with fifth years, I tried to, you know, to explain them clearly to them as well, that I call them my three R's. So be respectful, be responsible, and be real. And, you know, being real is be honest, be open, and don't be afraid to stretch yourself. You know, don't be afraid to be vulnerable. Don't be afraid to try new things. And for me, RP 8 years ago was a very new thing. But I felt that I was finally coming into a phase of my teaching that felt more like me, more authentic. And it actually gave me, it was very affirming because it affirmed why I went into teaching, because I was coming to the stage where I was thinking, I have 20 or 25 more years of this, you know, and I'm going to have to, I'm going to have to cut myself on here, you know, and get myself together. So it was been great.
I suppose my journey to RP, I came to teaching kind of later in life. I'm only qualified since about 2015 and I'm only teaching since 2017. And so when I started teaching, I went straight up to the resource department and became the SEN coordinator. And as part of that, I had to do where I was asked to do a postgrad in SEN, which was brilliant. And because I had just done the dip, you just kind of see that huge gap in knowledge or training that you don't get as part of the dip at that stage. But within that, and I suppose along with some of the students that I was working with at the time, I have always been drawn to the behaviourally challenged students, or where there might be like emotional or social difficulties there. And Tom had kind of said to me a few times that I think you'd really like this, Ciara. And it took me a while. It took me about a year, I think, to actually go and look it up. And I remember going to the training day with Michelle Stowe as well. And I had a huge kind of personal emotional shift with it. And I suppose the kind of getting an understanding around shame and guilt and blame versus harm and all of that. And I remember being asked on the day, or we were all asked, what was the difference between shame and guilt, or did we feel there was a difference between it? And the only way that I could explain it was that when she said shame, I felt it in my chest. And when she said guilt, I felt like it was external to me. And I suppose, like, going through the course of that day, and then she also introduced me to Brené Brown, which was just hugely, like, I went home and binged on it on her for the weekend. But it kind of just, it made me think, if I'm the age that I'm at, and hearing about this or learning about this is kind of having this shift, or maybe piecing these things together about me and who I am and what my worth is, that children or adolescents need to know this information kind of as they're growing up. And there's research out there that says that schools can be some of the most shame-filled environments around the world. And whether we consciously do it or unconsciously do it, shame can be used as a behavioral management tool. And I suppose it just made me think about, like, shame, empathy, courage, trust, vulnerability, all of those big words that we don't necessarily understand or can put a feeling on it. And I suppose in terms of pedagogy, I put together a TY module on it, because I know we talk about RP from the perspective of the teacher or the staff or the adult that's leading it or whatever. But I feel like there needs to be an explicit knowledge or awareness for the child as well, that they need to be armed and equipped with information around what is their shame, what is their trigger to their shame, how does courage show up in their life, how does vulnerability show up in their life, and when it does, how do they react to it? Because if they don't have that knowledge and they don't have that awareness, it's not kind of a level playing field, or we're not going to both get out of it what we need to. So I suppose that it kind of, I seem to always tend to drive towards what's the student experience as opposed to what's the adult experience. But I can safely say, like, it also put a language on how it is that I wanted to be, or like when I was looking or working with these students for whom, like, managing themselves or regulating themselves for whatever reason, it could be trauma, there could be, you know, a diagnosis, whatever. It put a language on how it is that I wanted to be, but then it also gave me a language to help try to explain to them what was going on for them as well. So it's been, like I said, I don't teach a mainstream subject, but it has been hugely changing in, I suppose, how I run or manage the SEN department up there, because it also kind of gives me a language to be able to advocate for them. So when they're not able to put that language on it, I can go to the other adult or the other adults in the building and kind of explain where we're coming from on it. So it's incredibly powerful.
James talks about his own journey with RP and how he embedded them in existing and new practices. He especially explains how he has set up his classes in pods, which is not usual practice in secondary school, and especially before COVID.
Well, I suppose for me, what happened was I was my wife's primary school teacher. So I was chatting to her one evening, and like, we'd always kind of be talking about kind of different things that happen in schools, and because she's primary, it's a completely different viewpoint. And like what Tom said there, that line about don't smile until Christmas, like, that always blew my mind. I was kind of going, why would you be a teacher if that's what you're going to do? And like, I would chat to Carolyn and I'd be like, do you know, you might have had a student teacher in working with you, and you're like, oh my God, I actually think that person, first of all, hates teenagers and then hates teaching. I don't know why they're in this. And trying that method of don't smile until Christmas. And I never got it. I couldn't understand it. But I knew that there was something there in how I was approaching my teaching. And I came back from, I teach accounting and maths. So I came back from this accounting conference, and there's an unbelievable accounting teacher who used to run those conferences. And she had this great idea, like, about getting them back into groups. And she was saying, we need to go back to primary school, where they sat in groups all the time, and group work and cooperative learning and all those different things. And I remember changing my own classroom around. And like, I remember people kind of looking and going, ooh, what are you thinking? Like, that's crazy. Like, you know, how can you do that? Like, and I remember one bunch I had in fifth year, an ordinary level maths class. And they walked in, and they're good lads, but they'd be characters, like, and they were kind of just said, what's this, primary school? Why are we sitting like this? You know, and, but I was like, no, I'll persevere with this. So I knew that was something about my teaching that I was like,
there's no point in not smiling because I'm 5'8" in an all-boys school. Like, that's not going to work for me trying to have this harsh approach. So just one evening we were chatting anyway at home, and Carol said to me that her school had the whole school training for RP, and she said, there's this person, you need to look her up, Michelle Stowe. And so I did look her up, and I signed up to go to this conference for RP, and it was out in Maynooth, and I had signed up to it, and then I sent an email to other staff, and I sent it to Tom, and I was like, Tom, I think you'd love this. This Carroll School have done this, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm actually going to go to this. And you replied to me, you're like, you won't believe this, I'm actually speaking at that conference. So he was just ahead of where I was on it. And I was like, really? And then it kind of just grew from there. So I did all the levels of training as well. Like, and like, I suppose it was lovely to have a name on what you were doing, that you were kind of going, no, I'm not mental up there in room 208 where I'm have them sitting in groups and I'm encouraging them to say, no, I haven't a clue, or no, I'm just not feeling it today. And that would always be my line with the lads. I'd say, look, if you come in and say, I'm not feeling it today, that's much easier, because then we all know where we stand and we can work from there. And then I got a post as a year head then, and I never really got the suspension thing. Now, I've been there where lads have had to be suspended, but for me, I was always kind of thinking, right, we suspend them and they come back and then it just happens again. So I was like, what is the point in this? And I see the purpose of it. I understand why we have to have some of those measures, but I started to try and bring it in that, like, well, if somebody comes back from suspension, can we, I know you're doing it in reverse, but I was like, can we then have the restorative chat? So eventually that kind of made a bit of ground on that. And so that was good. And I was really happy with that. And then on one of the last courses with Michelle Stowe, and this always sticks in my mind, she said, you'll never punish the guard dog out of a student. And that always goes through my head. So when I see kind of conflict or something coming in or something about to happen in a class, I just think, you're not going to punish the guard dog. You need to think of a different way. And I think that for me, that's what sold it to me. I was kind of going, no, there's language around what I have been doing. And then I suppose from my wife's school, I was saying, okay, they're taking on board as a whole school. And I suppose they're a relatively new school. They're not going back to 1835 where you're trying to change an entire system. And just, I suppose, to feel that you're part of something as well, that you're not flying solo. And even the response to the email that time from Tom, I was like, oh, wow, so we are thinking this, but we're still working independently. And I'd like to think that we're coming together now, like, you know. But so for me, that was it. Yeah, that was, and it definitely, just your question about pedagogy, yep, definitely has changed how I would approach it. And even now I work on one of the teacher training programs. And when I give my feedback after being out on a placement visit, I would always kind of go down that end in terms of classroom management. But, you know, definitely don't smile until Christmas, because that won't work. But you have to find a common ground. And I think RP and even the structured questions give that nice safety net when you're starting off. What I do is at the end of fifth year, I ask them to fill in for me three lads that they'd like to sit beside and three lads that they think to do better sitting with. So it gives them some sort of ownership. Like, I'm not saying I'm going to put you into a particular pod. I let them decide. And generally speaking, they will identify themselves who they will sit with and mess with. Or so it takes it out of my hands. I don't have to deal with that end of it, which in my opinion is the way it should be. Like, I'm there to pass on the knowledge, not to tell Kira to put her phone away again or to stop talking to Tom or whatever, you know, that kind of way. Just, it's funny, and Kira uses the classroom I'm in sometimes, but there was a round table and it was being offered up last year. So I said, yeah, I'll take that. And so now it's my circle of trust. So you end up on the circle of trust if you just can't manage yourself in the group situation. So what happens is, rather than saying to them, no, you need to sit on your own, you need to get over here, you're not able to concentrate, I'm like, you're here beside me for a while. So then I sit down and I start working away with the person who's over there. And then I might bring another fella in. So like at the minute for my, I have four senior classes. For three of them, there's lads that are on that. And it's funny, like you'd say to them, then you'd say, right, are you ready to, and I'd be very jovial about it, be like, are you ready to integrate back in? And they'd kind of go, well, actually, I was thinking I might stay here for another while. Like, and it's interesting to see like these big guys, like they're nearly 6 foot most of them, like, and they're kind of going, oh yeah, no, I'll sit over here. Like, and even the setup in the room, like Ciara will know as well, like I light a candle like at the start of each lesson. But like even some of the lads now who will be chancers that kind of say, God, you better get that candle lighting before we get going on anything else. So I think the physical environment, they know that like my desk isn't in front of the board that they're looking at. It's over to the side. So it's never a case of I'm standing between them and what they're looking at. I'm constantly moving around the room. Now, there are sometimes, I suppose, that I have to go through a question, but then it's straight away I'm kind of going, okay, lads, you're on your own now. I'll be moving around and want to see what's happening. And I suppose when you look at the trying to be restorative about what you're doing as well, like if you're, like you obviously have to check that work is done, but I'd have a much different approach now. Like if I'm moving around the tables and I see that there's a couple don't have it done, I'd say, by the time I get to you, you better have asked someone else at your table, or you better have a good question for me about the work that you were not able to do, because I know you wouldn't just not do it. You know, that sort of way. So it's your language. And I think that setup allows you to do that. It's not a case of they're sitting in rows and I'm kind of looking down and I'm saying, yeah, I'm watching you. It's a much more relaxed approach. But I think for me, what Michelle Stowe would have said all along, that shared vulnerability, like you have to be willing to give up that control of the rigid role in the classroom where you are looking and you're watching everything that's happening. And that's scary enough to do initially. And it's especially scary for a new teacher who's trying to set themselves up in a school, and they might be worried that, you know, someone from management or a senior teacher hears their class. Because sometimes my classes, if you were walking by, you would say, whoa, is this his first year here? Versus is it his 17th year here? Because it's loud, like, and the lads are chatting away, but they know then when to come back into it. But that's the vulnerable side, that you have to open up to that, and you have to say, I believe that this is a better way of teaching, so I'm going to put myself out there. And like, there are days where I have to stop the lesson and say, lads, come on, like, this is for you. The benefit is for you. So I'm not saying it's plain sailing, but there is that sense that you go, yep, I'm putting it out there, lads. I'm going to chance it with me. And generally it does work. Now, I know there's some learners that still want the, especially with maths and accounting, they want just the rigid approach, and they get that. But I eventually get them around to my way of thinking, I think. Well, I hope anyway. So, but that would be, I suppose, trying to still use that pod system and to get them to engage with it. And I suppose asking each other. And like, that would be the thing. I'd be like, have you asked the person beside you first? And I would never, I never try pairing up like a weak student, and I'm doing inverted commas there, a weak student and a strong student, because I don't know if that does anything for anyone, but that's just my opinion from a pedagogy point of view. And I think it removes that shame element, because a student definitely knows if they are the weak student paired with the strong student. And then I also say to the strong student, it's not on you to teach that person. Like, yeah, great if you're willing to help out. And I'd always say, the more you can explain it to somebody else, it will improve your understanding, but it's not your job to do that. And I can think of a couple of lads I have in fifth year that are phenomenal, and they're really generous with what they do, and they're really, really kind and help others. But it's to get that balance, I suppose.
One of the main differences maybe with primary school, apart from the obvious age of the students, is that there are much more pedagogical constraints. And I think it's fair to say that the system is very exam focused. Tom tells us how the restorative approach can help navigate this.
For me, RP, a practical application of it, where it's most evident would be I'll give you an example with Leave Insert history classes, for example. I would regularly, well, the first class of the week, I would normally have a check-in, just a very quick check-in. But at various points throughout the year, and I would do this with other classes as well, but I'd use Leave Insert history as an example. So if we're coming towards an end of a topic, I would preferably get them out of the classroom and bring them down to the concert hall. And we just say, okay, everyone grab a chair and let's make a circle. And we start off with a check-in, kind of low stakes. And then it give them an opportunity to, and me an opportunity to take stock of where we are and what they enjoyed about the topic, what they found interesting and what worked for them from a teaching and learning point of view and what didn't. And you have to be open enough as a teacher to realize that, you know, very often or quite often or maybe seldom, but at times you don't hit the mark. And you may think that that you're doing well, but in actual fact, the feedback can sometimes give you pause to thought. And I think that's a very positive thing. I also find it's great for planning ahead then. So I'll explain to them what we're about to move on to. And it allows me to look at the methodologies that I'm using. So what worked well in the previous topic, that I can employ more of that. It also works really well from the point of view you mentioned exams, to try to, in a way, take the sting out of exams or make the exams meaningful. Because, say we're approaching now for the for our third years and sixth years, they'll be doing their mocks very soon. So instead of what I would have normally done, maybe just giving each student 30-second appraisal. On their paper, give them their paper back in it and say to them, if you want to discuss this further with me, I'm happy to do that. But to do circle work on the exam as well, and to get their feedback on what, you know, the pluses and the minuses. So what they found, what worked for them, but what are their work-ons in terms of exam management, and then really give it over to the students. Like what's going to be the best use of time from here on in? And, you know, to go back to the training with RP, like one thing that I try to return to a lot is that you communicate your expectations clearly, but I'll also ask them what their expectations are. And provided, you know, I think that the more you practice in a restorative way, the more you build those relationships, because they're the key relationships for me in the classroom are fourfold. They're two interpersonal and then two what I would call interdisciplinary. So the interpersonal are the relationship between the student and students. And then the second one would be the teacher and the students. And then the interdisciplinary would be the syllabus, how the students engage with the syllabus, and then how the teacher engages and guides them through the syllabus. So they're the four key relationships. And my role, our role as teachers, as educators, is to hold that to be the center ground in that and to hold that those disparate elements together in a way that makes sense and in a way that's meaningful. So communicating your expectations clearly, but also supporting them in getting there, working with your students. So I've found those methods have been really, really useful, and the students have as well, because it allows for an open exchange of views and a meaningful dialogue. Where you can affirm good behavior and what's working well in the classroom, and then make plans that are going to be meaningful. To come to your point then about the exams and the expectations of exams and exam focused. For me personally, I firmly believe, and this is something that I would use as a coach, say in sport as well, that if the process is right, if you work with your students in a positive way, in a planned way, and there is that two-way dialogue, the exams are secondary. The exams take care of themselves. I don't want to sound flippant about that, but I think that certainly in the first phase of my teaching, I put the cart before the horse, or what I thought I was putting the horse before the cart, that it's all about the exams first and getting them prepped for that and getting the syllabus done and you know, hitting the targets and, you know, working them into almost like inadvertently into a frenzy about the exams. And your attention, it transmits to them. They can pick up on that. Whereas I think, and then hopefully then, you know, a good rapport will follow. Whereas with restorative practices, I think that, you know, having a foundation in your class, working with your class right from the beginning, and building that sense of trust, of shared agency, and that they know that you're committed, you're invested, but you also expect that from them. And, you know, I would never ask of my students what I wouldn't be willing to give myself, in terms of commitment and dedication and support. And I think to go back to my point earlier on, we can all remember back to our own school days or who were the teachers that you could sense that from them. And I think then that the exams become not the prime focus, but they're certainly a focus, maybe a joint focus, or they're, you know, unfortunately we can't pretend they don't exist, you know, they do. But I think that if the process is solid and sound, if that makes sense, that the exams then become less of a burden, and they become an opportunity for them to, you know, to show what they've done and to achieve.
Kira tells us about the program she's running and how she explicitly teaches RP and emotional intelligence.
So as Brené Brown developed a Daring Classrooms program, so that was kind of a start. I couldn't say that I used the kind of framework from that, but I basically have taken the topics individually. Well, we look at shame and empathy first, and we dig into what shame is, how it shows up in our lives, how it physically feels to us, how we might recognize it. If we're triggered, how might that affect our behavior to those around us? Getting them to look at their wanted and unwanted identities, all of that, and then how empathy is that antidote to that. So the power of being able to share your story with the people who have shown you over time, it can be shared with. And we look at what trust is, because it's such a small word for such a big thing. And we break that down, and we look at courage and vulnerability together as well. Yeah, so shame, empathy, trust, courage and vulnerability. What I do is at the start is kind of just throw out the word. So I just ask them to either try, if someone came to the door now and said to you, define for me what vulnerability is, can you put words on it? So can you do a word association? Can you put a definition on it? Is there a feeling that comes up or whatever? And like in their groups, and then they kind of feedback. And I suppose you can kind of start to see common threads, like the trust one is interesting. And I do use, I use Brené Brown's braving to break that down. So boundaries, reliability, accountability, the vault, integrity, non-judgment and generosity, being generous in our assumptions. And hearing when you just throw it out to them straight away and they're coming up with what it is trust for them, like to see some of the common threads, and then to see some of the things, or to hear some of the things, I suppose, that they would say it differently. But and I actually had a class, the module that I'm doing now, very early on into the class, one of the lads said, well, she can't trust anyone anyway. And I was like, right. And I kind of just took it and went through the lesson, and we broke it down into the seven stages. And then back towards the end, I was like, so do you see now why making that statement, you can't trust anybody? It's such a blanket statement for something that's so in depth. So now what I would hope for you is that it's not that you would say you can't trust someone, but that you might say, I have an issue with your reliability, or I have an issue with your judgment of me if I'm sharing something difficult with you. So it's not just this blanket thing. So yeah, that's kind of how it's like there's no assessment piece in it, or anything. Like, it is a discussion, it's a self-reflection piece, it's like a safe space, I suppose, to kind of explore all of those things. And I don't force participation either, because I'm quite aware, especially when you're talking about shame, that can be quite triggering. So if you have somebody that's quietly keeping to themselves, I'm okay with that, because they're still being exposed to and processing what shame might mean for them. And if it gave a fraction of a shift to them at that age that it gave to me when I was a lot older, I would, like, that's kind of job done for me, really. And I suppose it's not necessarily, it was RP that started me off on that journey of, like, being so interested in it, but it's not that I go into those classes with an RP head on me, for want of a better phrase. I suppose, and I think you probably, like, the RP is more kind, it's a way of being more so than a system. Like, we don't RP anybody. It's just how we go about our daily lives. But I just think that at that age, and I remember when I was in school, and I'll give them personal stories of when I was in school and how, like, I didn't know what anxiety was, you know, those type of things, or where it was coming from, or and how unnerving that is, and then how that can impact you going into later life. And, like, I always say to them, this might mean nothing to you now, but maybe in 10 years time something might happen that you might just think back to, okay, this is a time where this is vulnerability, and I need to be courageous as well. And the two go hand in hand. They're not separate. So it's just kind of trying to expose them to language about themselves that I think is of value to them. But I think it's creating that awareness for them so that when they're going into these other interactions outside the room, and we'll talk about, interactions with teachers, like, we don't discuss names or anything like that, but, you know, and we'll pick apart, well, what was happening for you there, or what do you think might have been happening for the adult in the room? And it's just as the giraffe, raising yourself up to see things from other people's perspectives. So, yeah, it just felt important to me that they needed that information or to be exposed to it.
Lastly, they talk about the resistance they can meet sometimes and the shift of culture RP require.
Yeah, I suppose one of the points that I have found using RP is that it is a cultural shock. Like, never mind for us as adults, but for students, you know, when you invite them to the RP session, their initial thing is, so am I in for a detention, or is it going to go further than that? And you're saying, no, I'm asking you, would you be willing to come to a restorative chat about this? And it's generally the person that has done the harm, I suppose, that they're a little bit shocked. They're kind of going, so you mean we're just going to have a chat? And then am I getting suspended? And you're saying, like, that's what I found initially. The first few times I ran a student-to-student session, that idea of, oh, you're actually going to listen to me, as opposed to, like, this is what you did, this is the sanction, that's the line in the code of behavior. So I think that's really interesting. And it's still the case that, you know, our students are only starting to see that now, that they're kind of saying, oh, there is a different way to this. And I suppose it kind of links in with what Kira had said earlier. We don't know what a student is bringing in any day, any class, in fact. Like, we don't know what happened in the previous class. We weren't there. We don't know what was said by a student, by a teacher, by a parent. We don't know what text they got during a class or during break or walking along the corridor. So I think when that gets embedded in a school, or even if it's not school wide, but if they know that a number of teachers have that thinking, that this teacher is not just going to go straight to the hard line on this, that we will be heard. I think that's powerful in itself, that students feel that. And the cohort that are in here at the minute, they might not get a full RP experience, but as Kira said, like, they will look back on it and they might think in years to come, when something happens, do you know what? I'll take a step back. I'll think of those questions. And what I found is that they're part of my vocabulary now, that if I am chatting to a student who has got a discipline line, my first thing is I ask, what happened there? And then the student will tell you, and I say, what were you thinking? And, you know, it's now, it's part of it. You go, what were you thinking? Oh, who's been affected by that now? And oh, what could you have done differently? And it's just, it rolls off your tongue now. And before you know it, like it's, as Kira and Tom said, it's that way of being, as opposed to, oh my God, where are the six questions? Have I skipped one? Or, you know, that sort of way. And I think that's really powerful. But I think there's still work to do, that, like, that shock element when you go, no, you're not straight for the chop here. We are going to talk this out first. And I think that's great, though, that students are seeing that now. And there's a good network of us in the school that are doing that. And we kind of chat to each other and we say, hey, would you run a session here? Because I want to be impartial on this one. And like, even say with management, that they've sat in on some of those, like the two cases where I had guys coming back and they sat in and just observed what was happening there in the chat. And we got the parents in for one of them as well, which was great. Like, and you're bringing everybody in. So for me, I think that's where we're going. But I still think in society, there's a lot of work still to do on that.
Yeah, I suppose. And like, just to speak to the kind of the shift, or the shift in culture, I suppose, that happens, like, and you or James had mentioned, you know, that it could potentially be more difficult for a new teacher starting out to take it on. But I think it's equally and sometimes maybe more difficult for an established teacher to take it on, because they have been a certain way for a very long time. And then and especially if it's not something that they're coming to themselves, if it's something that's been brought in to the school and kind of put on them, you're asking them to be a very different way. And then, as James said, the student then has to get used to that. So there's now been this big shift in how we were as to how we are now going to be going forward. And we both have to figure out how we're going to be in that new space. And there's a shift in boundaries, all of that. So it is scary. And it is that thing of relinquishing control to it. Because now we've moved the goalposts, now we've changed the boundaries, we don't know what way or direction this is going to take. The student doesn't and the teacher doesn't, and that's can be like a scary thing, like when you're taking on or not taking on, but you know, when you're engaging with an adolescent, especially somebody who you know, has difficulty with behavior. But the risk and the fear of losing, giving over that control, like, is just the positive effect that has on the environment, or even just on your one-to-one relationship with the student. It just far outweighs that. And I think it's just kind of saying to yourself, going to take a deep breath, going to give this a go. Who knows? I don't know what way this is going to go, but that's what it is to be vulnerable. That's what it is to be courageous. That's what it is to be empathetic and to tackle shame and all those things. And like, there is so much more work around our society's understanding of shame and empathy and what courage and vulnerability is, and that it's not weakness and all of that that has to be done. But when we have practices like this coming into schools, when children are at a stage where they're developing and they're deciding who it is that they want to be or how they want to be in the world, like, if that doesn't eventually pay off in shifts in society, I don't know what does, so, or what would. So for any small way that you can bring that into your day or the day of your student, it's hugely powerful.
I just think as well, Dorothy, that there can be resistance to RP, and you know, from within and also from the wider world, because there is a countercultural element to it in its framing and its thinking. But I think society is changing and developing and opening. You know, for example, I think in our Western culture, we've tended, or we to go towards, and Kira mentioned earlier on, one of our students saying, I don't trust anybody. That we've tended to look at human nature as being, well, there's a veneer of civility, and underneath lurks the selfish, nefarious, you know, urges and impulses of humanity. Where in actual fact, I think it's the opposite. And the RP affirms that I think human beings and humanity is fundamentally good. I think that's a great lens, a very encouraging lens. And it's something that I return to time and time again to remind myself when I'm feeling the pressure. And, you know, it could be the the middle of a long term, and you're beginning to feel frayed at the edges. And I'm sure teachers listening to this will understand exactly what I'm talking about. To go back to that there's a reason why we do this, and there's a reason that got us into this. And I think as well that there can be a perception of the restorative approach, and even the practices that are associated with it, like the check-in, like circle work, group work, like the restorative questions, that it's a little bit out there. It leads to permissiveness, a slip in standards. And nothing can be further from the truth. From my experience, it is minimized disruption. It has minimized conflict in my working life with my students. I was just reading this morning that Jacinda Ardern, I know this is going to go out in a while longer, but she's stepping down as Prime Minister in New Zealand. And I wrote this down because I thought it was brilliant. And for me, this is so restorative. And as a teacher and a restorative practitioner, she said that this made sense. She said, "You can be kind but strong, empathetic but decisive, optimistic but focused. You know, as long as you're true to your values, our values are like an anchor. And provided your values are soundly worked out and clearly understood by yourself, and perhaps even clearly expressed to your students, I think that they'll figure them out anyway. I think that's when it becomes really meaningful and transformative, and really transformative."
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our show.